Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us here at TruthWorks Network for our auto-documentary form of 500 Years Later. 500 Years Later is a film gauges the authentic retrospective voice told from the African vantage point of those whom history has sought to silence. Learn, grow, and discover yourself. TruthWorks Network.
I'm going to be a boy.
Africa, its whole history, long before the Europeans came to our shores. But the Europeans came to our shores, and because they were attracted by what those who came first found. In our case, it's gold. And the first European establishment, which was established in Ghana, was established at a place called Edna, which they called Elmina, the mine. Because gold was so abundant, and they came with their manufactured products in exchange for gold, you know. So the Europeans initially came to our country to trade as partners. It is perhaps the era of the slave trade, which changed the perception of Europeans about Africans, when our own people were regarded as commodities.
It is difficult to be precise about exactly how many millions of people were lost. And we can look at the kind of repercussions, if you like, of transatlantic slave trade, both for Africa as well as for Europe and the Americas, to see what effect it had overall. But historians tend to think that the population of Africa is much lower than it would have been.
since we can't get the actual numbers, we can, from looking at population numbers that we do have from some areas, get a general sense of the size of Africa's population and a general sense of the size of those who were enslaved.
Nobody could be absolutely certain about how many Africans were taken. And we need to begin our estimation of this with the understanding that most people, when they do this estimation, think only about the European trade in enslaved Africans. They don't think about the Arab trade also, which is much older. But a closer estimation would be something like 200 million. I've seen this put up, and it's a shocking figure, I know, but I think it's much, much closer to the fact, 10 million, because those 10 million generally are calculations of the Africans who were landed in the Caribbean and the Americas, who were landed legally. There are many Africans who were murdered indirectly as a result of the activities of the enslavers, some of whom were Africans, especially after a certain point in time. And they were murdered indirectly because of famine, because of disease and so on. These were the direct results of the social dislocation that happened as a direct result of the slave raiding. And we have to begin there. Then there were Africans who died on the march to the barracoons on the coast. There were Africans who died in the barracoon. There were Africans who died in droves aboard the ships that were used to bring our ancestors to work, in the words of Eric Williams, for lashes instead of wages in these parts to help to build these shining cities of the damned in which we are so penned up today. And we have to make calculations for all of these.
You tell me to forget that my grandmother was born right there, folks. All right, I say I shall go. You tell me to forget. It is there I want my own children to go. All right, I say I shall go. But I hope you understand how I feel about Emerson, my homeland, my homeland, my homeland.
In recent propaganda about the slave trade, you're hearing that blacks in Africa sold their brothers and others, and that the whites are not responsible. But you never hear to whom the blacks sold their brothers and other blacks.
The only thing they try to do is make us responsible for our own enslavement. And here, they could last three kinds of people and victims. You do that.
There were Africans who collaborated with the Europeans, but there were Jews who collaborated with the Nazis. There will be Iraqis who will collaborate with the Americans. I mean, that is the way sometimes history is.
The Jews are never called responsible for their Holocaust. Only Africans are, you see. We don't say the Jews are responsible because we know in the final analysis it's the Nazis that killed them, just like we know it's the whites that killed us.
There was no way that millions of people could have been taken out of Africa without African involvement.
So the only way you were going to have a slave trade is you had to have Africans who would go in the coast and bring other Africans out to you.
The fact is also that many African rulers and many African societies tried to prevent the trade taking place. And what has to be remembered is that it started off in a small way and then it escalated over the centuries. So in other words, African societies or African rulers may have become involved in it because initially they thought there was some advantage to be gained. Say, for example, you have some captives in your society or some people who have committed some offences or some people you just want to get rid of because they're political rivals. You may have exchanged those individuals for something that you as an African ruler or African merchant thought was desirable, whether that was some manufactured good from Europe or whether it was firearms or whatever it might be. But then having, if you like, entrapped yourself in this trade, it became very difficult for African societies to pull out of it. One of the reasons for that, which historians point to, is what they call a gun trade cycle. That is to say that the most modern, up-to-date military technology was brought to Africa from Europe. If you were an African ruler, it was to your advantage to have that technology, to have guns. Because if you didn't have guns to defend yourself, it may be that the neighboring society would have those guns and they would come and enslave you.
All of this benefited only one set of people. Not the Africans, benefited the Europeans.
The majority of the Africans who were kidnapped from the continent of Africa were kidnapped by force and by violence and through warfare. That's how Africans were kidnapped, brought out of their villages, brought down to the coast, and then put on those slave ships. In fact, no African country, no African nation in West Africa ever was a slave economy. No society in Africa had its principal mode of production as slavery. No, did not exist. That was only something that the Europeans invented and created.
African languages, there is no word that means enslavement, when enslavement means what Arabs and Europeans have done and continue to do substantially to African people.
And there was no such concept as chattel slavery in Africa. It did not exist. I know it is said that we enslaved each other. What, that was not chattel enslavement. That was a similar system all peoples have had, forms of servitude. That was what we had in Africa. And we know that even with those domestic forms of servitude, that there were rules and regulations. It was not about a total denigration of an individual's humanity.
And the sheer horror and magnitude of, in fact, deculturalizing a human being to the point where he or she are simply seen as beasts of burden and as chattels, movable property, are in fact the differences between slavery in West Africa and slavery in the Americas.
In 1789, entitled The Interesting Narrative of Alada Equiano, and Equiano writes about being born in Benin, what is now eastern Nigeria, and he was enslaved along the coastline within Africa by at least two families before taken to the coastline and sold to Europeans. And he says in the narrative, he said there was a lot of difference between my enslavement in the interiors of Africa and my enslavement in Europe. He said there is no comparison. He said in the African system, and I'm just quoting Equiano here, in the system, the slave was part of the family. And the indications were that the enslavement was not permanent, much like indentured servitude in England. Equiano says, once he's in European hands, everything changed. That he saw the most abominable cruelties he had ever witnessed in his lifetime.
Different ways of killing them, boiling them off, burning them alive, skinning them alive, burying them alive, quartering them, and leaving them for brain dead in the Western Hemisphere. We have to talk about that. Because if we don't talk about it, and we don't talk it in dignity-affirming terms, we'll never be able to do it.
This is a slave chamber. Slaves will keep many, many days of suffocation, starvation, and the amount of betrayal. This place was special for women plus children. Women and children are kept here in this room, 75 people. But long term, especially for slaves, they were next slaves, one man, another. All of them keep here together, 75 people.
To take somebody away by force from their community is one of the most savage acts you could think about doing. And we can't forget that.
Not just burning some small thatched roof houses. but destroy towns, cities, villages, great works of art, great literatures, and the people that made that art and literature. Songs we would never hear, histories we would never know, art we would never see, because the European had the capacity to destroy and didn't have the moral restraint not to.
I shudder when I come here to Elmina. Some people call it a castle, but it's really the dungeons. And the reason I shudder is because the most horrible things happen here. And I'm most touched. And in fact, the thing that disturbs me most is that right here behind me was a church, situated over the dungeons. And all around this church were dungeons where hundreds of Africans were held in bondage. And on Sunday mornings, you could hear the wail and the moans of the African people combining with the sacred or so-called sacred hymns of the Christian people to produce the most terrible dirges of death you would ever hear. And the African people would always say, as I say even till this day, where was God then? Where was God when all of the horrors that happened here, when the brutality that happened to the Africans happened? This is the question that must be asked. It's the question that cannot be answered, because actually it was human beings who did this.
It's very important that we not only teach that, you know, Africans were picking cotton. That wasn't the reality of slavery. Slavery was very dangerous, not only for the African, but for the slave master, for the people who dared to enslave other humans. Slavery was a very dangerous business, and resistance was a reality, an everyday reality with slavery. Africans resisted on ships. They resisted in Africa. They fought wars in Africa. They fought wars in America.
Of course, the image is always given that the Africans themselves acquiesced to the process of slavery. But you'll find that in West Africa, there was a polity or a political entity that existed that guaranteed security right across West Africa, and that was the Songhai Empire. We saw the emergence of Nasir al-Din in the 16th century. We saw Malik Si in the 16th century as well, and men like Abdul Qadir and Cherno Suleiman Kaba. These men who waged resistance in what is known as Futa Toro and Futa Jalon. And then you see saw the emergence also of men like Mohamed El Amin and Mamadou Toure. Of course, we had Azinga in the southern areas of Africa as well that was fighting its resistance against European invasion. All the way up until through the 17th century, the emergence of men like Sheikh Uthman ibn Fudio and Umar Futi, as well as Ahmed Lobo. And then we had the courageous war that took place in 1884 under the armies of Muhammad Ahmed ibn Abdullahi, as well as Muhammad Abdullahi al-Hassan of Somalia. And then we had in 1903, finally, the wars that took place between the Sokoto Empire. So the Africans did not acquiesce to colonialism, nor did they acquiesce to slavery. They fought at every point. And in fact, when the slaves were landing in the Western Hemisphere, in Bahia, Brazil, you saw the emergence of jihad movements. You saw the emergence of men like Muhammad Usambo, who led a two-month jihad in the Louisiana territories in North America. Men like Nat Turner and other men who refused to submit to slavery. The Haitian Revolution as well, men like Macintal. So the Africans never acquiesced. To slavery. In fact, we can say this here, that the whole concept of freedom that the American 13 colonies had, they got that concept of freedom and liberty
through the eyes of a victim. I don't see any American dream, I see an American nightmare.
All the ideas about African inferiority in one form or another, which were developed as justifications for the slave trade and for the subsequent oppression and exploitation of Africans under colonial rule and so on. So racism is clearly one of those key problems which has confronted Africans, not only Africans, but the whole of humanity.
It pauses our life condition. It makes people hate us before they even know us. They redefined us out of humanity so that a person from Iceland got a concept of us and never saw us or interacted with us. Do you understand? So what they've done is poison how we can relate to each other.
The system of racism, white supremacy, in my analysis as a behavioral scientist, as a psychiatrist, is that it is a behavior power system that is local, national, and global, organized by people who classify themselves as white, consciously and or subconsciously. It's carried out in all areas of people activity, economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war. It determines patterns of perception, patterns of logic, thought, speech, action, and emotional response, as well as symbol formation.
Honor them and they honor you. Disrespect and disregard them and they vilely treat you. Their arrogance is but skin deep, an assumption that has no foundation in morals or in law.
I think if you are shocked when you go to a country that is predominantly black, and you think, wow, black doctors, black lawyers. I didn't know that. That's racism. Because that means, it means you believe the hype, the stereotype, the ideology, yeah? So the knowledge that is fed to you of someone or something, which is completely not true. Just because you are married to someone of a different race doesn't mean that you are no longer a racist. Just because you have mixed race children doesn't mean that you're not racist. And certainly because you're black or mixed race doesn't mean that you're not racist.
They're always subject to, like, the whims of those in power, you know? And, I mean, it might not be, you know, getting beat up by a police officer. It could be just being, you know, sort of summarily dismissed from work for no reason, you know? It could be you earning not as much as someone else for the same amount of work. It could be someone not showing you an apartment. Not even not giving you the apartment, but not showing you the apartment. There's, I read about this new study where they're doing voice recognition, and so people kind of, if you sound black, then they'll just tell you the place is not available anymore. But if you sound white, you know, come on down and have a look. And then they find out you're black, and then they're like, oh, it's not.
L'Afro africaine, non, maintenant ça va. Leur intégration va changer, malgré que ça soit déjà intégré, mais ils sont pas acceptés partout. Que ce soit dans le milieu du travail, dans l'école, dans l'économie, dans la politique. Il n'y a pas beaucoup d'Africains, je trouve, et je trouve ça dégueulasse. Parce qu'il y a certains pays où ils sont acceptés bien, comme aux États-Unis par exemple, mais en France, ça n'existe pas et moi ça me fait chier, tout simplement.
The black experience is about what this means to you in everyday life, in your job interview, at university, on the street, when you're shopping, everything about what this means, how you get served when you go abroad, yeah, how people communicate with you, what opportunities and doors open for you are shut in your face. Is anybody rushing to be that?
What we are seeing in Barbados is perhaps a rapid desegregation in terms of blatant discrimination. Because up to when I was at school, which is nearly 40 years ago, one knew that there was a color bar in Barbados. Barbados was synonymous, as was South Africa, as was Bermuda, for color discrimination. And blacks knew that wherever there was a plantation, you simply did not go there. Where there were concentrations of whites in business, in entertainment, leisure activities, you simply did not go there unless you wanted to work as a menial. Now, we have happily passed that stage, but there is still the residual fact that cliques, small cliques and small groupings of whites can still come together and mask their discriminatory practices in this society by, say, putting up one brown person as manager of a firm or something else like that, and then having an over-concentration of whites in that firm. These firms still engage in a subtle job reservation program, right? So they recruit people from all over the world as long as they're Caucasian. And our government is acquiescent in this, and therefore highly skilled, highly professionally qualified Barbadians are located lower and middle management level, and then there's a glass ceiling which is painted white.
Somebody blew up America. Somebody blew up America! It wasn't the Klan or the skinheads. Or the them that blows up nigger churches and reincarnates us on death row. It wasn't Trent Lott or David Duke or Giuliani or Shuna Helms retiring. It wasn't the gonorrhea in costume, the white sheep diseases that have murdered black people, terrorized bees and insanity, most of humanity as they please. They say, who say? Who do the same? Who has been paid? Who tell the lies? Who in disguise? Who had the slaves? Who got the buck out the buck? Who got fat from plantations? Who genocided Indians? Tried to waste the black nation? Who live on Wall Street? The first plantation? Who cut your nuts off? Who raped your mom? Who raped your father? Who got the tar? Who got the feathers? Who had the match? Who set the fire? Who killed iron? Who said that God and still be the devil? Who the biggest only? Who the most goodest? Who do Jesus resemble? Who created everything? Who the smartest? Who the greatest? Who the richest? Who say you ugly and they good looking? Who defined art? Who defined science? Who made the bombs? Who made the guns? Who bought the slaves and who sold them? Who called you the names? Who say Dahmer wasn't insane? Who invented AIDS? Who put the germs in the Indians' blankets? Who thought up the Trail of Tears? Who blew up the Maine?
Treatment for African people, and we see the results of that every time we take a census of the madhouses or the prisons of the West. African people populate those places in numbers that are far out of proportion to our presence in the population.
You lock up 1.5 million African American men. You can't tell me that you have not perpetuated the institution of enslavement. If you lock up that many brothers and sisters, you have reinstituted the institution of enslavement. Because when they get out of jail, can they vote? Since that's your criteria of citizenship, can they get a good, decent job? Who's going to help them deal with the fact that they either raped or were raped by someone?
Males have caused a or what shall we say, destruction of black family life. And when we look at all of the young black males who are caught up in drugs and who are caught up in dropping out of school and in the prison system, I maintain this is because of the destruction of the black father and removing him from a functional role in black family life.
The school system doesn't teach them the truth about who they really are and their full potential. Now, once they know who they really are and their full potential, when they see these stereotypes, they don't connect with them. They don't see them as representing who they really are. So all those images on them in the media are false representations of someone who they are not. But unless they have that alternative frame of reference, if you like, to connect with, they are at risk of being what it is they are told they are.
When you listen to some of our dancehall music and some of our rappers in the UK, we're literally boasting that we're showing the world, look, this is how ignorant I am. You know, I want to drink this amount of whiskey each night. I want to smoke this amount of blunt each night. I want to chase this amount of women each night.
In order for hip-hop records to sell in that number, who is buying it? It is middle America. It's middle England. It's the majority white community who are buying these things because they present images of black people with which they are comfortable. They're not comfortable with someone like Common or The Roots or anyone who is playing, you know, authentic, intelligent music, because that doesn't make any sense in racist middle America or racist middle England. That's not an image anyone wants to see. No one's going to be comfortable with that. But you have someone with his trousers hanging down his legs, wearing a bandana, holding his genitals, talking about, you know, how he's out on parole. This is something which is very comforting and very reassuring.
All you have to see is bad news. All you see is the negative. You don't see, you know, anything about African civilizations, African culture, African history. As far as most people in the West, you know, Africans still live totally in my heart. When you watch an MTV music video, you're not watching a music video. It's a multi-million pound advertising campaign for capitalist organizations which are teaching our young people how to be fools, how to buy and how to consume products that they don't need. It's teaching them that they don't need any aspirations other than to have a baseball cap, that flung gold chain, that jeep where they go bounce up and down, and all the other kind of nonsense that keeps them from seeing wider than the targets that have been and the ambitions that have been set forth for them.
Yeah. When I was younger, we had a sense of responsibility from a very young age. This may be responsible of fetching water, looking after the animal livestock, whether sweeping up the yard, catching some firewood. I think these discipline that you gain when you're very young, in my time, help me to hold in good stead when I become big. Children nowadays, especially in this society, very much a lot of freedom they have. We quieten them by giving them TV or games, things not really encouraging them to do anything but play, and after a while try to impose responsibility after that. So they hadn't learned this ability of responsibility. So I think that's some of the contribution why we have problems with our children.
And what we have to do is work in tandem with our young people. We've got to stop being afraid of our own children. The African proverb says, children not taught by their parents will be taught by the world. And the world got some terrible things to teach them. So teach them the legacy of the past. Teach them the great minds, Malcolm and Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, W.B. Du Bois, Martin King, Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Sojourner Truth, Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, Julius Nyerere, Yaa Sanju. We've got to teach them that and pass it to them as a legacy. Teach them the best of what it means to be African. Teach them Odu Ifa. Teach them Busia. We've got to teach them that. Then that's not going to drop from the sky. And the white man is not going to teach them that. You know what the white man does? He engages in what we call memory replacement. He lifts our memory out and put his in. That's why a lot of times black people can't remember their name. That's why they say their name is John and Stafford, Rachel and Ron and all that kind of stuff. Because they can't remember their name. You ask them what philosophy is in their history. They'll remember the Greeks. They won't remember Amenemope, Ptolemy. We must recover our memory. We must return to our own history and culture. Until we recover and reconstruct the best of our history and culture and use it to enrich and expand our lives, we'll always be impoverished. and our youth will suffer as a result of that. We must leave a legacy worthy of the name Industry African.
Of the globe. Obviously, Europe is dominant, has been dominant, and has had power over us, not only in our history and so on, but the concept of oneself and how we identify ourselves. So that plays on what we consider beautiful. The problem with that is that this mentality still exists now to this day. And with the forces of globalization and, you know, images and how we can transport images very quickly, the concept of beauty is portrayed onto us, then we idolize that, then we internalize that, and everybody wants to look the same.
I don't know how to move past that. You just have to have more images, I guess, of African Americans and, you know, people from Africa from all over the place, and not have them all look like Halle Berry or Vanessa Williams. I mean, they're very attractive women, but when that's the only, when those are the only types of black faces you see, it doesn't really help just because they're black. It doesn't, I mean, it's really not a diverse image, you know.
And of course, since I'm not considered beautiful, what I would look to is to try to obtain that idea of beauty. And of course, not only does that cause physical pain in terms of straightening your hair, you know, bleaching your skin, but it's, mentally it's very, very, very enduring, and also it plays on your own self and your own self-esteem.
And as the people in Africa and Asia get some power of their own, they get a mind of their own. They start seeing with their own eyes and listening with their own ears and speaking with their own mouth and coming to definition from their own brain. The European definition now isn't necessarily the definition.
Brown versus the Topeka Board of Education decision ended school segregation, and Thurgood Marshall argued the case. One of the things that worked so well for Thurgood Marshall's case was a psychologist or psychiatrist who had taken young black children into a room and introduced them to black dolls and white dolls. Without any prompting, he would ask the kids, pick up the doll that is prettier. Pick up the doll that is smarter. Which doll do you like the best? Each time the child would pick up the white doll.
Coming from a country where you're used to seeing people who look like you in power, when you're used to seeing like your prime minister looks like you, your treasurer, your, you know, whatever, your head of the army, the head of the newspaper, the head of the media station. I think seeing that instills something in you and helps you to have more confidence in what you, in your own abilities. And I think that's something that people coming over from different countries in Africa and from the Caribbean have that African Americans don't have.
Well, for most of the history of America, black people weren't in a very strong position to define themselves. Economically, they were in slavery up until, you know, for much of the history. We worked in jobs where we didn't have a lot of economic freedom, which meant we didn't have a lot of social freedom. We had our own point of view, but we couldn't impose it on people. That has changed a lot in the last 30 years or so. So there's more black people who have the power to create images of their own. We live in a world that didn't exist when I was born.
Everybody has to, if you like, to understand their history, their past, and the role which culture plays in the lives of human beings. You can't exist as a human being outside of a culture. We all speak a particular language, we all have a particular way of living, lifestyle, and so on and so forth. So these are all, if you like, aspects of culture which are important. But they have to be, you know, they have to be fully recognized. for us to really exist as human beings. And I think that's something which is very often being denied to people or devalued in one way or another, as if the cultures of people of African origin, particularly those in the diaspora, but also the continent, are not seen as being as important as the cultures of Europe or the languages of Europe or the institutions of Europe and so on.
It's like the problem is we want to forget about our own roots, and then adopt the ways of rest, which is not compatible with our own. So you can't really believe why we have a problem, and this is why the gap is getting wider and wider. But what we are trying to do is we match with our own culture, with our own societal norms. So you find out that at the end of the day, we end up failing in illness, whatever we do.
If we make a concerted effort to deny who we are as black people and to deny our history as enslaved black people, I think it isn't possible to acculturate fully into a white identity or European identity.
So if kids find difficulty, for example, connecting even with the Caribbean, if they grow up in Britain, so no, I'm not going to do the Caribbean, I'm British and so on. Well, sure, they may be British in terms of citizenship, but in terms of national origin, they have a definite national origin which should be encouraged, promoted. Otherwise, how can they exist as a kind of fully rounded human being if in some way they're always feeling they have to deny their culture and their national origins?
Oh, well, we're sitting in now, we're one society, we're culturally diverse, so we don't have to deal with none of that. But then if we forget about our culture, sooner or later there won't be no need for diversity, because then effectively we're all the same. Where's the richness in that? So the thing about the world is everybody's different, and you learn to appreciate different cultures. But we seem to be casting off these things because we're in one society now, and I want to be like him and look like him. Conformity to that degree is really spoiling our people, because we have no boundaries now. And that is what might prove to be the problem.
But you know, our history in the Caribbean has been that of a dualism, because whereas on the one hand we have had the Pan-Africanist sentiment and we've had this very progressive form of resistance to slavery, on the other hand we've also had the accommodationist Eurocentrism, to white racism, and on the other hand we've had resistance. And I am arguing that the highest form of resistance that we developed was Pan-Africanism, the Pan-Africanist form of resistance.
We argued in the 60s that the key crisis and challenge in black life is the cultural crisis and challenge, and that until we rescue and reconstruct our culture and bring forth the best of what it means to be African and human in the fullest sense, we will never realize our full potential. And until we use our culture to break the monopoly that the oppressor has on so many of our minds, liberation is not only impossible, it's unthinkable. And what you can't conceive, you can't achieve. So we must use our culture to bring forth, again, the best of what it means to be African and human. Speak that special culture truth to the world and use it to make our own unique contributions to the forward flow of human history.
And institutions that do not engage in healing, they simply open the wounds and entrap me in rooms where I am consumed by hypocrisy.
Hey, day of my life. Education for me has to be looked on two levels. The first one, the so-called training that we receive in school, and we understand that it is indeed training, because all it's about is regurgitating a curriculum or regurgitating a set of rules to then pass an exam. But we must also understand that education is also about getting self-confidence, so being proud of who you are. So we must also study the history of our past, i.e. African history.
and the statues on campus be watching me. Washington, Jefferson, clocking me. As if to say, my time's up. But I don't run laps on track, see? I run laps around the scholars of tomorrow, because their new schools of thought are merely our history's borrowed. And they label me militant and black national radical, trying to put my learning process on sabbatical.
It was very cool to be well versed, to know all the bits and pieces that we have to learn, knowing poetry by heart, to be able to say, look, I've learned, I've studied, I did this, and if you are number one in class because there's ranking, you're very popular. However, it was a culture shock for me when I came to this country, and it was a complete reverse, where if you knew nothing, and if you spent most of your time at school creating havoc rather than trying to learn anything, then you were more popular.
When you look at the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Will Smith is street smart but school dumb. And when we look at Carlton, Carlton is school smart but street dumb. Now what happens is that we're told that Will Smith is the one we're supposed to be aspiring to. He gets the lady, he gets the girl, everyone loves Will. And Carlton, the one who can't dance, you know, nobody wants to be like him, getting all their grades and being the dork, you know, the one who lives in the mansion. No, they want to be like Will. You've got to think about, well, it's only a little comedy. What possible impact could that have on an African psyche? But then if you're an African and you have children, then you know.
What the hell good is Brown versus the Board of Education if nobody wants it? I mean, this is the future, and all of these people who've lined up and done whatever, they've got to be wondering, what the hell happened? Brown versus the Board of Education. These people who marched and were hit in the face with rocks and punched in the face to get an education, and we got these knuckleheads walking around, don't want to learn English.
Black children tend to be typecast, you know, you're going to be the next Mariah Carey or Whitney Houston or the next Dwayne LaDeja as opposed to the next Professor Maggie Yacoub or the next President or Prime Minister. These are aspirations that aren't really in their daily life. How we're trying to combat that, I suppose, is to show them it is possible. A lot of people who work here are professionals and they're black professionals. So the children do see something they can apply to, aside from the secret verified.
We do not have black schools, we do not have black institutions of further education, apart from the Saturday school movement. And this is really, really needed in Britain, because the mainstream education has proven that it's not able to meet our educational needs.
But it's not designed to educate us in any shape or form, and so it's working perfectly well, just not for us.
The main obstacle in the society is obviously not for you, so that puts something against you and you have to work that much harder to succeed.
Malcolm X summed it up brilliantly as the killing field, and therefore if we are to say that we want our young people to do something positive within their life, then it's absolutely imperative that we actively get involved in their education.
Black people, you can make major decisions on children's education and you don't feel it's necessary to ask a black teacher. Hello? I mean, sometimes because I think like I'm in another time. The time warp, like the twilight zone. And the problem with that is that the complacency. And that is when you see that we're not too removed from slavery sometimes. But unfortunately, we're still in a system where people think for us and feel for us, and do the curriculum for us, and design for us, and everything for us, and the IQ for us. And then we just slot in. Because it's not like as if they're doing anything wrong. You see, you mustn't think it's kind of malicious. It's kind of a mindset again, a conditioning. We're disciplined not to ask you, so we don't ask.
I look out through dirty, battered neck and future ascend. I look out for someone to come and save me.
In school, they don't teach the people about their heritage, you know, about the African culture. They don't teach the people about the vital role that the black people played in society.
Well, this is indicative of why we need to be connected to our past, why we need to know what happened to us as a people. Because if we can't tell our generations that you actually achieved something, why would they feel a sense of achievement? Why would they feel a sense of identity? They have to know what happened before, and they have to be able to relate to it and say, I did that, my people did this, we are somebody, we can do something.
Public education, unfortunately, does not then anchor African-Americans in the tradition of Africa. So consequently, people float.
When I grow up, I'd like to be a doctor.
Let's be a successful leader and
let's
be a
doctor. I want to be a doctor.
When I'm older, I would like to become a basic lawyer.
When I grow older, I like to become some type of scientist, say a microbiologist, because here our science class is very interesting to me to learn about things like that.
During the colonial era, colonial governments, namely Britain, France, Germany, and Portugal, had to find a way to efficiently run their colonies. So they set up mission schools. The Africans received a colonial education. It wasn't so much that these colonial governments wanted to educate their subjects, so to speak, but they wanted to educate and create an elite few that could help create efficient and effective colonies.
The kind of education that we have, unfortunately, is to still enslave our minds, to make us believe that we are inferior. Whatever it is, that is superior. To make us believe that we can't make it, which isn't true. If I am educated in my little way, I can be in history. I should be able to know what are the things that transpired in the past. And what can I draw? Or what can I understand from those events and draw anything for the future? So one should use his or her education to help himself, that is by enlightening his situation.
Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us here at TruthWorks Network Radio for part two of the audio documentary of the film 500 Years Later, The Compelling Epic Journey of Africans Struggling to Freedom. You may find part one of our broadcast of this wonderful film 500 Years Later in our archives here at Blog Talk Radio. TruthWorks Network Radio proudly presents the audio documentary of the film, 500 Years Later.
Healing in institutions that do not engage in healing. They simply open the wounds and entrap me in rooms where I am consumed by hypocrisy.
Hey, day of my life. Hey.
in my life.
Education for me has to be looked on two levels. The first one, the so-called training that we receive in school, and we understand that it is indeed training, because all it's about is regurgitating a curriculum or regurgitating a set of rules to then pass an exam. But we must also understand that education is also about getting self-confidence, so being proud of who you are. So we must also study the history of our past, i.e. African history.
And the statues on campus be watching me, Washington, Jefferson, clocking me, as if to say, my time's up. But I don't run laps on track, see, I run laps around the scholars of tomorrow, because their new schools of thought are merely our history's borrowed. And they label me militant and black national radical, trying to put my learning process on sabbatical.
It was very cool to be well-versed, to know all the bits and pieces that we have to learn, knowing poetry by heart, to be able to say, look, I've learned, I've studied, I did this, and if you are number one in class because there's ranking, you're very popular. However, it was a culture shock for me when I came to this country, and it was complete reverse, where if you knew nothing, and if you spent most of your time at school creating havoc rather than trying to learn anything, then you were more popular.
When you look at the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Will Smith is street smart but school dumb. And when we look at Carlton, Carlton is school smart but street dumb. Now what happens is that we're told that Will Smith is the one we're supposed to be aspiring to. He gets the lady, he gets the girl, everyone loves Will. And Carlton, the one who can't dance, you know, nobody wants to be like him, getting all their grades and being the dork, you know, the one who lives in the mansion. No, they want to be like Will. You've got to think about, well, it's only a little comedy. What possible impact could that have on an African psyche? But then if you're an African and you have children, then you know.
What the hell good is Brown versus the Board of Education if nobody wants it? I mean, this is the future, and all of these people who've lined up and done whatever, they've got to be wondering, what the hell happened? Brown versus the Board of Education. These people who marched and were hit in the face with rocks and punched in the face to get an education, and we got these knuckleheads walking around, don't want to learn English.
Black children tend to be typecast, you know, you're going to be the next Mariah Carey or Whitney Houston or the next Dwayne LaDeja, as opposed to the next Professor Maddie Yacoub or the next President or Prime Minister. These aspirations that aren't really in their daily life. How we're trying to combat that, I suppose, is to show them it is possible. A lot of people who work here are professionals, and they're black professionals. So the children do see something they can apply to, aside from looking for verified.
We do not have black schools, we do not have black institutions of further education, apart from the Saturday school movement. And this is really, really needed in Britain, because the mainstream education has proven that it's not able to meet our educational needs.
But it's not designed to educate us in any shape or form, and so it's working perfectly well, just not for us.
The main obstacle in this society is obviously not for you, so that puts something against you and you have to work that much harder to succeed.
Malcolm X summed it up brilliantly as the killing field, and therefore if we are to say that we want our young people to do something positive within their life, then it's absolutely imperative that we actively get involved in their education.
I want to be a pilot in the future.
I want to be a pilot.
timeline of future.
I want to be a fan when I grow up. You don't invite people. You can make major decisions on children's education and you don't feel it's necessary to ask a black teacher. Hello? I mean, sometimes I think like I'm in another time. The time warp, like the twilight zone. And the problem with that is that the complacency. And that is when you see that we're not too removed from slavery sometimes. So unfortunately, we're still in a system where people think for us. And feel for us, and do the curriculum for us, and design for us, and everything for us, and the IQ for us, and then we just slot in. Because it's not like as if they're doing anything wrong. You see, you mustn't think it's kind of malicious. It's kind of a mindset again, a conditioning. We're disciplined not to ask you, so we don't ask.
I look out through dirty, battered neck curtains, teacher and son. I look out for someone to come and save me.
In school, they don't teach the people about the heritage, you know, about the African culture. They don't teach the people about the vital role that the black people played in society.
Well, this is indicative of why we need to be connected to our past, why we need to know what happened to us as a people. Because if we can't tell our generation that you actually achieved something, why would they feel a sense of achievement? Why would they feel a sense of identity? They have to know what happened before, and they have to be able to relate to it and say, I did that. My people did this. We are somebody. We can do something.
Public education, unfortunately, does not anchor African-Americans in the tradition of Africa. So consequently, people float.
When I grow up, I'd like to be a doctor.
I want to be a doctor.
When I'm older, I would like to become a basic lawyer.
When I grow older, I like to become some type of scientist, say a microbiologist, because here, our science class is very interesting to me to learn about things like that.
During the colonial era, colonial governments, namely Britain, France, Germany, and Portugal, had to find a way to efficiently run their colonies. So they set up mission schools. The Africans received a colonial education. It wasn't so much that these colonial governments wanted to educate their subjects, so to speak, but they wanted to educate and create an elite few that could help create efficient and effective colonies.
The kind of education that we have is unfortunate. It's got still enslaved our minds. So make us believe that we are inferior. Whatever it is, that is superior. So make us believe that we can't make it. It is not true. If I am educated in my little way, I can be in history. I should be able to know what are the things that transpired in the past. And what can I draw? Or what can I understand from those events and draw anything for the future? So once you use his or her education to help himself, that is by analyzing his situation.
Africans must begin to institutionalize the ideals and ideas of the African giants that God Almighty sent to us as a people to raise us up as a people. We are the ideals of Marcus Garvey being taught today outside of the independent grassroots movements and organizations. What institution and what school teaches you the ideology and philosophy of the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey?
There's a lot of black heroes that I've never learned about, but I can tell you a lot about Henry VIII or about Queen Elizabeth. Can't tell you much about Marcus Garvey though, unless I found the book that one of my brothers read. And if I didn't find it, then I wouldn't have known.
What institution teaches you today, outside of the joining the religious movement of the Nation of Islam, the ideology and philosophy of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad? What institution today teaches you the ideology and philosophy of the Prophet Nat Turner? But you realize today that with the death of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, James Madison, that even with their death, no matter what the charisma they had, the institutionalization into the Constitution of America, into the institutions of America, universities and schools, that today you have to go to school and learn about these individuals and the principles that they believe in. And even though George Bush and Bill Clinton are 41st, 43rd, 44th president, that you would find that they still stand upon the legacy of the first, second, third, fourth, fifth president, because their ideal of America has been institutionalized. What universities, what elementary schools, what high schools and middle schools, what JSS institutions, SSS institutions do we have that you can go through the institution and come out knowing who Gabriel Prosser was, who Denmark Vesey was, who Nat Turner was, who Booker T. Washington was, who Malcolm X, El-Hajj Malik Shabazz was, who Leroy Jones was? Is it mandatory reading? Is the ideal in their philosophy mandatory reading?
African-centered independent school. We are Philadelphia's oldest independent African-centered school. The underlying purpose of the school, and that is to provide an educational opportunity for our children that is founded on the basis of culture that is steeped in African culture, history, and tradition. We feel that it's important for our students to be grounded and have a good understanding of who they are, the accomplishments of our ancestors and those who walked before us. And in all of the subject areas, this particular foundation is reinforced. Whether we're teaching math or history, science, or social studies, we infuse the African perspective. So Lotus provides an opportunity for our students to learn to think, communicate, and problem solve within the framework of an African perspective.
You can't pay me back. You can't pay me back for that missed opportunity.
And everyone else has gotten, like, money for all the wrongs that were done against them, but, you know, somehow black people are, like, you know, immune from litigation. So I think that's a really good question about how would they be dispersed, because in a way I just think, okay, just give everyone, like, their, not their criminal 48 years in the view, but just basically give every black person their something, because even if they're coming from the Caribbean, even if they're coming from Africa, they were still affected by it, and, you know, give everybody something. Yes, I think we could use reparations. I don't know if they should just go as, like, cash handouts, or if they should go to sort of, like, empowerment zones. That's really the main question I have, is not whether, but how.
If every African American in the country got, you know, a $50,000, you know, windfall, I'd expect to see a lot more Lincoln Navigator sell, you know, and things like that. I wouldn't expect the African American community as a whole to pour that money back into, like, creating affordable housing for itself, and you know, insulating itself from the outer forces that have acted upon it.
Anyone ever compensate? Anyone? Who would be compensated and how? I mean, you check it out, I mean, somebody gets like £25,000 for an industrial accident, right? So how are you going to compensate? How are you going to compensate people for something on that scale? It's not possible. It's not possible.
The only possible way that I can conceive of reparations for things like this, the historic inequities that were created by the institution of slavery, would have to be addressed again institutionally. If somebody suggested, for example, African American students can go to school for free, that's a discussion that can be had, because it can be had, because it may in fact address a historic inequity. If I could not own land in, you know, 1792, and some, you know, William Smith Johnson in Boston could, the appreciation of that property over that many years, the opportunity costs are too great for money to address that problem.
If you have a McDonald's and you have 20 people working on every shift for 8 hours, that's 5-15 times 20 times 8, how much money are you saving a day? They didn't have to pay nobody. For how many years? How much money is that? And then they handed it down from generation to generation. Black people didn't have nothing to hand down except spirituals and hope, and people can't live off hope. It takes money to feed people. It takes money to clothe people. Can't hope for some food when it's going to be right there in front of your face.
Happened in the past. It was a long time ago. Why blame me for what my ancestors did? This is another ridiculous notion. The modern day Europeans have inherited directly all the liabilities as well as the assets of preceding states, preceding organizations, commercial companies, and all other organizations, all other entities. It's part of law, European law, that if you inherit a state or a company, you inherit both the liabilities and the assets. And in this way, Europeans have inherited the consequences, good and bad, of their forebears. It was a minority of Europeans who owned enslaved Africans. But the vast majority of Europeans, all Europeans, have gained from the enslavement of African people, because the economy of Europe is an economy that was built upon the enslavement of African people, not only, but substantially.
I don't think people really understand that, you know, with how much they've actually gotten from slavery. They think that, okay, we had slavery, and then we had the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, we had Reconstruction, and then that was it. Things were fine. You know, you could work. You could fix shoes. You could work in the mall. You could do whatever, whatever, which isn't true because you had Jim Crow. And then even after that, you know, things weren't better. So now, theoretically, you can work wherever you want. But, you know, first you have to go to college. And before you go to college, you have to go to a good school. But your school is not good. And why isn't it good? Because your neighborhood is segregated, which in and of itself wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing, except that schools are locally funded. And so if you're living in a neighborhood and your school is, you know, funded by property taxes and nobody owns a home there, then what good is that doing you? And so, yeah, I think I'm for them. I don't believe this nonsense about it causing a bigger rift and making matters worse and, you know, opening old wounds, because I don't think wounds have actually been healed. Maybe if this happened, you would be able to have some sort of sense of closure, or at least the beginning of closure, the beginning of a dialogue.
So reparations is a total project. First, it involves a public discourse. We got to talk about it. Because Europeans always want to deny what they did. And sometimes blacks don't even understand what happened to them. They know something happened, but they can't righteously get it together. So we need this public discourse. Then we need public admission. Admission of Holocaust. Not admission of trade, all that. You know? Business gone bad with collateral damage. We need a Holocaust, a morally monstrous act of genocide. People have to confess to that. And the government has to do it. You know why the state has to do it? The state has to do it because the state sanctioned it and protected it with law and guns.
Why not an apology? Well, it would be simple, wouldn't it? Slavery was wrong. It was abominable. We're sorry we were involved in it. Why is it so political? Because of the guilt of it, for one. And secondly, the fear of reparations. If there is an apology, then there is an admission of wrong. And I think the fear then is it would open the nations up, both Britain and the U.S., to lawsuits and to reparations. So both are the same. Blair, Bush, Clinton before him, will stop short of an apology, will not apologize for slavery. They won't do it. I think Blair is on record saying it was legal at the time. So nothing, no apology in order. There's no need. It was legal. Wow, that's interesting. But the Holocaust was legal according to Hitler. You know, but it's very wrong.
Babylon did it. Assyria did it. France under Napoleon did it. Germany under Prince von Bismarck did it. America under George Washington did it. Africa with 400 million black people can do it. If you cannot do it, if you are not prepared to do it, then you will die. We can do it. We shall do it.
Environment don't try to change me unless I want to, because God the Almighty said I don't change a man until a man is willing to change himself. You have to want that change.
And a lot of black people like they like to complain about things that's going on in the community and about like why schools are not getting better or about why people are not cleaning up the streets or whatever, and it's because, you know, a majority of black people don't vote. And if you don't vote, how can you complain? You can't complain. I mean, you have to be making a difference in order to say something about the difference being made.
At the end of the day, what is going to get people to do things together is ideology. Because we have different experiences, even if we're black, but we could be going in opposite directions. And now I know there were many millionaires who were black millionaires, but they may have off licenses. They might be selling pornography. I'm not interested in that black empowerment. I'm not interested in that.
You see, one of the problems we have is the silence from the people that know. They complain about what's happening, but they don't organize. They're vulgarly individualistic.
Too much time around here, people see things through the white man's spectacles, through the slave master's spectacles, even creator. I and I now have to start seeing it through our own spectacles. Because it's only I and I to redeem I and I self. No nation ain't going to redeem I.
Victory for us as a people will occur when we stop seeing ourselves as victims. Right? Yes, we've been victimized, brutalized, commodified, and objectified. And so we've taken on the notion of victimhood, that victim means that this is my being. But we didn't come into the world as victims. We don't say we're victims of birth.
The biggest obstacle is not believing in ourselves that we can actually do or perform the tasks that lie ahead of us. I mean, this lack of confidence, that is the result of colonial indoctrination, you know, is one of the biggest obstacles. And the way to deal with this obstacle is simply look at our past and to look at our achievements. As I said, our ancestors have achieved a lot and have been self-reliant and creators of cultures and civilizations. And there's no reason why we cannot derive inspiration from there. And so long as we do not derive inspiration from our past and from the achievements of the past, we cannot really make any headway.
We hold the keys to our freedom. Nobody else can set us free. We, the oppressed people, have the keys to our freedom because we are the ones who've been down so long that we know what it's like to be there. And we're the only ones who can restore humanity back along the path that was set for us from creation.
We are to say that we are the future when our elders have gone in the physical, then we need to put down the guns. We need to start having meaningful relationships with our African brothers instead of acting in a slack way, so that we can have positive, productive and fulfilling African family units.
All for this going back to Africa, don't get me wrong, I am. But you know what I got my message for the people is? Nobody go with your long hand. Africa no want people with nothing come in. Because things over in Africa is tough. Get out of this roses and running through the park business. Go over there and teach. Go over there and do something constructive. And don't go over there expecting Africa to owe you anything. If you go over there and you're going with something constructive and you're going with love, I think you will prosper. But if you're going over there expecting Africa to owe you something, I think you better stay where you are because you're going to be disappointed.
Come on, it's African, man. But live Africa, eat Africa, wear Africa, love Africa.
To be African means to own my connection with my history without apology. I just love being an African woman. I just think it's the best thing. You know, I really do. I absolutely love my African-ness. And I'm grateful to the Most High God for it. Would never want to be.
So to embrace Africa is not just to wear the kente cloth or to wear the dreadlock or to speak an African language. It means to take on the African soul. That is, either a person must embrace the inner soul of Islamic Africa or the inner soul of Abyssinian Christian Africa, or either the inner soul of traditional Africa. This is what it is to be an African. And if you don't have this thing, if you don't have this connection, this inner connection with the African continent, then your African entity is just a name without a core.
Who will take Marcus Garvey off the wall and the poster and off the book on his bookshelf? So I will live it out. I'll return back to Africa. Marcus Garvey was not allowed to go to Africa because the imperialist forces said, don't let him in. He was not allowed to go to Liberia. That's why he didn't go. But we're allowed. What holds us back? What government is saying, don't let Kohain Netanyahu Halevi into the country? What government is denying people walking on African soil?
Brother, his house got broken into. I tell you, man, his house gets broken into. I come in the apartment, everything is everywhere. They took his laptop, they took his television, his stereo, PlayStation, CDs. They even took photographs. For what? I don't know. They took his photographs, took his watch. They cleaned his brother out. Get to the bookshelf. Every book untouched. They didn't even lift one book off the shelf. Every book, perfect, just like he left it. Every book, they didn't touch the book. He could have had $1 million in the book. They didn't want to have nothing to do with those books. Prove them wrong. Read. They hide factual information in the books because they know we're not going to read. So read. Our intelligence is our perhaps our greatest resource because it is something that we control totally and completely. So why don't we use that same intelligence instead of creating wealth for other people's? Creating wealth and being the resources of other people, why don't we control our resources in real ways? Control our minds in ways to apply our minds to ideas, to apply the resources that we have access to in order to create viable products.
Si je dis à côté de cela que c'est hyper difficile pour moi à Paris, moi je dis franchement que je me considère comme étant vraiment malhonnête, que je me mets à la place où je suis.
Because the time has come for the black man to forget his hero worship of other races and to create and emulate heroes of his own. We must canonize our own saints, create our own martyrs, and elevate the positions of fame and honor black men and women who have made a distinct contribution to our racial history.
We also need to get together and form some kind of business organization amongst us black people. You know, because like I say, we're the largest consumers in this country as a whole. You know, everybody plays a major role in this country, and the only thing blacks play in this role are being consumers. We need to patronize one another and love one another and find a way to make things work for ourselves.
Why hasn't it been done? You know, why hasn't it been done after so many years? You know, you look at other ethnic, there's a lot of things that they have done that black people never done. Why? Is it white people fault or is it black people's fault?
Because quite frankly, we have the power. As I say, we have the power. You know, we do. We do, but we don't use it. And then on top of it, we make them feel that we don't. So we're caught between a rock and a hard place. So the bottom line is they're afraid. Because if we was to really believe in who we are, we'd be terrible. We'd be terrible. You see, and then you wouldn't have to ask me why those places are not there, because they would be there.
How do we reverse the after effects of slavery throughout the society? How do we claim our full place in society? The first is to reassert and continue to assert our identification with our cultural traditions, with the best in African and the African diaspora culture. And part of that is to see how universal it is, how connected we are to the folk cultures, to the people's cultures of people throughout the world, so that we tread not only on our own ground, but we share this common cultural ground with the people of the world. And we should draw from that richness, and we should give back to the cultures of the world from that richness.
How do we preserve the culture that has preserved us? We must look at that which makes us distinctively African, the best of us, identify those principles, and begin to share those principles, value those principles, hold on to those principles, and let no one come in between that.
A people without a past are a people without a history, and the people without a history have no roots, and the people without roots have no foundation, because there's no people on the face of this earth today that are anybody who do not know their past. So we as African people, we must remember our past, no matter how harsh, no matter how horrible, no matter how great. We must remember the good, and we must remember the bad. And remember, for African people to have survived the horrors of slavery and colonialism, it doesn't testify to a weakness, it testifies to our strength. We're not embarrassed and we're not ashamed. Those who enslaved our people should be ashamed. We have survived that history.
We're going to teach our children true and proper history, true and proper culture, true and proper ethics, morals. We're going to teach our youth to take their minds out of a Eurocentric prison and literally elevate them back into their own minds. It is absolutely essential that we see the world through the eyes of an African people.
By knowing ourselves better and by making that cultural connection, we are not threatening anyone. We are simply developing our intrinsic strength and bringing those strengths to whatever national formation that we are part of, whether we are part of the British nation or the American nation. We are bringing a new strength to the segment of that nation that we comprise.
Several things preserved us as a people, as an African people, throughout the Holocaust of enslavement. The first and most important thing, I think, is our deep spiritual roots, our capacity to believe in our own humanity and to hold on it in spite of the most dehumanizing situation. That capacity to reach inside ourselves and find beauty, meaning, and freedom in spite of the most oppressive conditions in the world. We must carve out of the hard rock of reality the place we want to stand on and leave as a legacy for those who come after us.
We've got to make certain that our people know who we are, know where we're coming from, understand what has happened to us. That's the only way that we'll automatically be able to identify our own interests, to promote those interests, to defend those interests, to live Africa instead of just talking about it. And we've got to find ways, as people who think we know, of ensuring that this knowledge and these attitudes and these objectives do not remain with a small group of us, but become the common possession, the common desire, and the common objective of the vast majority of our people. I think that this is one of the most important and urgent tasks facing us now. And if we could find ways of achieving that, we could depart from this world with smiles upon our faces.
Elamina is one of the most incredible, horrible places on the face of the earth. More Africans pass through here than any other fortress on the West African coast. But it has remained a citadel. And it's a citadel in some senses of the loss, of the suffering of the African people. But in another way, it is a citadel of hope. And as the sun sets even this evening on this beautiful coast, hopefully it rises again tomorrow on the optimism and the hope of a new generation of Africans who are ready to take over the reconstruction of the African world and to end 500 years of misery in our lives.
Network Radio. You have been listening to Our Common Ground. I'm Janice Graham. Tonight, we honor those who march in the long line and progression of Black history, Black progress, Black resistance.
And thank you for being with us here at Our Common Ground tonight as we honor Black history and culture for the Black History Month of 2011. Doc Don, house music lover, your legal analyst, and our guest, thank you so much. You have been listening to an audio version of the documentary film 500 Years Later, which I think does much for us to recall and understand the bridges that have brought us safely across. I hope that you have had and are planning a very joyous and powerful Black History Month for your community, for your family, and especially for our children. We have seen a lot of things going on in our country this week. One of the things that we have seen is that the people who have brought us our weekends, the people who have brought us most of what is considered the president of human-based employer employment benefits in this country over a more than 45-year history. We have seen that state be taken. I'm not sure what's going on here, but we have seen that state under siege by the Republican Party and the Koch brothers, who have financed those who would seek to pare back, to eliminate employment benefits and features that set us apart. And in doing that, the setup is that union workers, union organizing, employees in the state of, like teachers in the state of Wisconsin, really are causing the state to be financially imbalanced. And we know that that is not true. We've got about 18 minutes in our program tonight, and Alpha is not with us. He is usually here co-hosting with me at our Common Ground on Saturday night. And we invite you to give us a call at 347-838-9852 to give us some feedback on our feature of 500 Years Later, on what you are seeing and what it means in our community if the people of Wisconsin, if the workers of Wisconsin lose. There will be we will see the same kind of activity in Ohio and Illinois. And as we all understand, we will also be the recipients at the first line of attack. It's really interesting that we sit back, and I'm not sure why, that we sit back and we watch, even the patriots watch this democracy under attack, and there are 60 to 80,000 people who have gathered in Wisconsin. But there are not 50 or 60 or even 30,000 who have gathered in our nation's capital to protest our democracy, or their democracy, under siege. Even the patriots, people who have voted for the kind of change brought to you by the Republic thugs and the Tea Party, simply have not responded, and I'm really wondering why. Our number again is 347-838-9852, and we'd like to hear from you. If we look at the headlines just tonight, the headlines are that the Wisconsin protesters are drawing large crowds, and they are looking to kill the bill. The notion that 70,000 people rallied in Madison, Wisconsin today, and you do not see that that is going to make a difference, really ought to be something that we fear. We fear in a way because we know that it is coming somewhere near to you. Even in Egypt, there was a release today of hundreds of political prisoners, and we are still appealing to the Bush administration, I'm sorry, to the Obama administration, to even include U.S. political prisoners in our appeal for human rights regarding to the U.N. We're still having that problem. Also, in our one of the things that I do want to note that in our in the news headlines today is that something interesting is happening in science. NASA will try next week to launch a space shuttle Discovery, and it will be its final voyage following a four-month delay about the fuel tank repairs. And liftoff is set for late Thursday afternoon, and senior managers voted unanimously Friday on the new launch date after discussing these fixes, cracks in the external fuel tank. But it will be the final launch of Discovery. And we have seen the history of Discovery, the Discovery series, over the last 35 years. And that's just a history note that I think that we need to make. Also, it was interesting today that Ed Schultz, the MSNBC commentator, responded to Rush Limbaugh, the radio commentator, by telling him, "Wrap your fat ass in the flag over Wisconsin protests." And there's a video, I understand, he tore into Rush Limbaugh for calling the protesters fighting the anti-union bill in Wisconsin freeloaders. And so he told Limbaugh that he should wrap his fat ass in the American flag. And he made these comments during a special Saturday edition of the Ed Show. And he was reporting live from Wisconsin, and there was a raucous crowd cheering him on. If you'd like to join us and give us some feedback, we're going to go to our phones right now. 347-838-9852 is our number. 405, you're on the air. I respect you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I respect you too, Janice. I think that you've had
a... Don! Good evening, sir.
Yep, this is me. I really enjoyed your presentation tonight. I think it sort of took us back to where we could reflect upon where we have come from and where we need to go and what our capabilities are. I think that when you speak of this space shuttle and the last one that's going to go up in this with this type of spaceship.
Discovery series, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, this Discovery. I sort of take a long-range view, and I project myself out up and away into the universe, and I take a look back on Earth, and I try to distinguish and see if I can find it in the galaxy, and I try to see us launching something from Earth into this vast mass of space and galaxies and universes. And I just wonder, and I contemplate, are we alone? You know what I mean? That's what I think about when I see us as fledgling human beings with our innate finite weaknesses, attempting to conquer and attempting to engage the universe, and how far it's taken us and how many years it's come and how we have evolved from horse and buggy, from walking to horse and buggy to going into space. And I just contemplate that, you know, and I sort of wonder about it, Janice. Takes me away from. Takes me away from the immediate.
It certainly is something that I think about a lot. I pay close attention to what's going on with NASA and our space program. Ron McNair was a very good friend of mine. He was kind of like a big brother. When I first went to MIT, I was kind of lost, and he was there doing some postgraduate work, getting ready for his career at NASA, and we kind of struck up a nice friendship. And he and his brother who also lived in the Boston area, became friends, and I was very young at the time. So that's how I became interested in our space shuttle programs. But one of the things that happened to me in terms of how Ron formulated the sense of space exploration was also formulated by my reading of Octavia Butler, and you know that I'm a big Octavia Butler fan.
Yeah, and you're
and
not alone.
I tell
but...
you, if you read Exogenesis by Octavia Butler and you pair it with people like Ron McNair and other astronauts and scientists who really take space exploration so seriously, you have to wonder that. And you have to look at what, you know, what I watch the Discovery Channel a lot, and some of the discoveries over the last 5 or 6 years regarding water, regarding air, regarding rock formation and soil formation. And you have to think, could it be true? And then you think, but wouldn't we try to, you know, I mean, white supremacy is so global that you would think, I mean, you look at movies like Independence Day and some of the others, and you think they would just try to take over.
Yeah, America has a sense of manifest destiny, you know, but the fact of the matter is that when you really look at it and contemplate it and think about space and think about this universe, we're insignificant. And,
I sort of look at these problems as
I don't get too disturbed and upset over the way that people are acting up on this planet. And, you know, that's why I take solace out of on my land and digging into that ground and that dirt and planting and reaping and, you know, and thinking about Mother Earth, thinking about sometimes I go way out in my back pasture, I get on my knees and I have a little meditation with the Creator out there, you know, and look into the universe and the blue skies and the clouds, and I'm by myself and I listen to the rustling of the wind, and I look at the lilies in the field. I think about that, you know, the flowers, the wildflowers, the vegetation that I have, you know, and I'm very thankful. And you know, so it takes my mind away from this, stuff that we encounter on a daily basis, this political thing.
Exactly.
Gives me a little solace. But anyway, I just wanted to let you know that you did a great there. We missed Alpha as always. I miss him, my brother. And you came through like a champ at the Olympic, as I knew you would. And I just want to congratulate you, Janice. Keep on keeping on. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Don. Thank you so much, Don. For those of you who are not regular listeners, that was the Don. That's what I choose to call him, calling out of Oklahoma. But it is true that we need to take pause. We need to think that there is something bigger than all of us. I have traveled extensively through Australia, New Zealand, Africa, Canada, in the Caribbean, in South America. And one of the things that happens when you do a lot of traveling, you recognize that there is, as Dick Gregory says, a universe that is whispering to us. It is beyond our politics, because sometimes we get consumed by our politics. Sometimes we get consumed about our military prowess. Sometimes we are consumed by having things. But we need to take the time to go to places, to spend time even in the space where we are, considering that there is something so much bigger than you and I. One of the things that I have been saying to people all week about Wisconsin, about what's happening in Tunisia, Gaddafi is acting crazy, and the many countries in the African continent are starting, small countries are starting to look at what happened in, to Egypt, to people power, that we have to first have as a priority to give peace a chance. I'm reminded of a song that I learned very early in junior high school, and it was a children's song about peace, and it resonates. Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me. With every breath that I take, let this be my solemn vow to love each other and give each other in peace, in constant peace. Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me. Thank you so much for being with us here tonight. We'll be right back here on Our Common Ground next Friday night. We're having a special on U.S. political prisoners. It's a teach-in Friday night at 8 p.m., and then we'll be back here on Saturday night at 10 p.m. at Our Common Ground talking about the issue of political prisoners, because peace begins, that most of us say, with democracy. Good night, and thank you, and have a glorious weekend and Black History Month. I'm Janice Graham, and this is Our Common Ground, speaking truth to power and ourselves. To Our Common Ground with Janice Graham at Blog Talk Radio. Thank you so much for being with us. We do our best to speak truth to power and ourselves. We hope you'll join us each Saturday night, 10 p.m., right here in the Wild Wild West.
Bye.